Hi, I'm Corey Rabin, and welcome to Crosstalk Podcast. And today, we have an amazing guest, a wonderful guy who I recently met at a Karen Treatment Center gala outing, recovery, gratitude weekend. I'm really happy to welcome Ben to our podcast today. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Corey. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
So what we usually do here on Crosstalk is we start from, you know, growing up years, childhood.
Yeah,
and like if you had three words that you were going to pick out as to describe your childhood, can you think of three words that would accurately reflect that period of time in your life?
Yeah, I would say, you know, loving, picture perfect. I mean, I had an amazing childhood. My parents were like obsessed with being parents. They were well off.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Newburyport, Massachusetts. I was actually adopted at birth. Which is funny. I was born in West Palm Beach and, my parents flew down a day or two after I was born and stayed with me in Boca, I believe, for a couple of weeks and then flew me back to Boston. Well, you know, I moved back down here.
Right.
Yeah.
So you grew up in the Massachusetts?
Yeah, just about an hour north of Boston. Super nice town. I want to say like a kind of sailing town on the water. It was yuppie. Really yuppie town, for lack of a better word.
So it was a upper middle class kind of?
Definitely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Your parents are alive?
Both my parents are alive. My adoptive parents, when I refer to my parents, I'm referring to my adoptive parents.
Sure.
They're both alive. My father just recently moved from out of Mass down to Atlanta. And my mom lives right here in Boynton. So I see her quite often.
So did they separate when you were young?
When I was 18. Yeah. Okay. It was a long time coming, but, you know, they did a good job keeping that from me and my brother until the time came.
Are you older or younger than your
brother? I'm older by a year and 11 months. He lives in Atlanta with his wife. They just had a baby about a year ago. I do have a half brother out in Iowa from my birth mother, who I found them when I was 22 and I went out there and met them as well, but not really in contact with them anymore.
Your brother that you grew up with, was your brother adopted as well?
No, actually he wasn't. So I don't know the precise details, but I believe my parents were told that they wouldn't be able to have children. So they adopted and then my mom got pregnant. Yeah.
Now, growing up, were you treated the same way as your younger brother?
Yeah, we were incredibly close, me and my brother growing up. Also, pardon me if I get like super emotional. I'm an emotional guy.
It's okay.
We did everything together. He followed me around. If I jumped on the bed, he jumped on the bed. If I, you know, spent every second with him, he was my best friend. He got sick with Crohn's disease.
Which is a digestive disorder.
Yeah, it's multiple things, like growth and digestion and stuff. So he was in and out of the hospital a lot, and that's kind of around the time we stopped being so close. I was 12-ish, 12 or 13, I think, when he got it. And
he was about 10?
Yeah, like 9 or 10. He was the smaller of the kids in his grade and stuff. Yeah, that was rough. But so when he got sick, my parents had to spend a lot of their time focusing on him, spending a lot of nights at the hospital together. And
were you with a caregiver, or were you alone at the house?
I was alone at that time a lot. It was kind of like that transition period where, like, oh, he's old enough, he can be home alone.
You were 12.
Yeah, 12, 13. Oh, and I was raised Jewish, so I was bar mitzvahed. And, 13, we're men. So there was a lot of me kind of pushing for that as well. Like, you know, oh, I'm a man in the eyes of God, so, like, you can leave me home alone. And, you know, we grew up, I had nannies and babysitters and stuff. We both did. So I'm sure, you know, here and there, there were. But I'd stay with, like, other people once in a while. Like, he would be in the hospital for a long time. Like, I think his longest stint was, like, 2 months or something.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Is he well now?
He is very well now, yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So when you were in that 12, 13 age group, you became less close with him because of his illness or because of other things?
Lots of things. Okay, so when that happened, when he got sick and he was in the hospital, I was starting to, like, go through puberty and wanting to be out more with my friends and whatnot. And at the same time was kind of left to my own devices when my parents weren't around. And that led to me, like, finding a girlfriend that was not good for me. And I basically was just, like, you know, on my own in a way. I didn't want to listen to my parents because they weren't around to tell me what to do. So when they were around, you can't tell me what to do, you know. Sneaking out to see my girlfriend. Yeah, it was, I just kind of left my family at that point.
You disconnected.
Completely.
And it was a combination of them disconnecting from you and your age.
Yeah.
And all the things that happen when you're 13 absolutely. And 14.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did that, was that something that continued until, you know?
Oh yeah, that's a huge theme for the rest of my life, was being a loner and, you know, on my own. So this girl I dated was very, like, did not like my parents. My parents didn't like her. And, I would sneak out and do all kinds of stuff, like steal my dad's car, sneak out, drive around. Cops would show up at her house to get me, to take me home. I was just, I didn't care.
How old were you when that happened?
14, 15. And trying to, you know, fit in and be cool that age. Like, I was hanging out with the wrong crowd, her crowd. And that's when I started doing drugs. Cocaine. I think, I want to say cocaine was, like, the first
one. Before alcohol?
Yeah, yeah. So I had, like, tried alcohol, like a sip from my dad's drink or whatever, at the temple, you know, once you're 13.
Wine.
Yeah, Manischewitz and stuff like that. I think you did, like, a shot of whiskey with all the elders in the temple. on holidays and stuff. So that was never really like something I wanted to do. That changed. Right. But yeah, so I was in this like awful relationship and I thought it was great. There was a lot of rebellion and, you know, my parents pushing back, you know, about, you know, how, like what I'm doing and stuff like that.
Did you ever feel like your parents were treating you unfairly?
Yeah. Yeah, big time. That was something I have definitely harbored for a long time, that my parents were like neglecting me and focusing only on my brother and like, oh, I'm like, who cares about me? You know,
did that connect to the fact that you were adopted and he wasn't, or was it just,
the thing with my adoption was it was so out in the open that I never had an issue with that. Mm-hmm. You know, that stereotypical, like, you're not my real parents. I think I said that one time in like the most insane, like rage filled fit ever. But like, no,
that was not a source of trauma.
No, not at all. They were so good about that. And making sure that, you know, I understood that that had nothing to do with it. You know, they're my parents, and they gave me a wonderful childhood until they couldn't. Mm-hmm. You know?
So you're now 16 going on 50.
Yeah.
What does life look like at that point? So you're now doing coke. Your drinking is not really the main event, but you're probably doing some of it.
Drinking happened around that time too. I think my first time getting drunk, I was 16. I was with a friend. Actually, we were supposed to go to Temple the next morning. And my friend came over. We raided my dad's liquor cabinet. My mom woke me up on the bathroom floor the next morning to get ready for Temple. Like, I got drunk first time. And yeah, it was not good. I was like throwing up. I was like drunk dialing people on the cord on the phone, like on the wall phone or whatever. Right away. Yeah. And then I think later that day, at Temple, like me and my friends like snuck out to like get coke and drink more or something after that. It was like immediately when I tried it. But really, I had no preference. I really had no preference. If anybody was like, hey, you want to try this, or oh, I have this, I was like, okay. Yeah, okay. I did not care what it was. Shortly after that, I tried heroin.
What age were you at that?
I was 17. Tried heroin.
How'd that make you feel?
Like I was in a dream. You know.
Was that the at that? It didn't really. You described yourself as trying everything.
Yeah.
It really didn't matter what you had as long as you had something.
Yeah, and at first, you know, I wouldn't say it was like me trying to cope or anything. It was kind of just like, oh, everyone's doing it. Okay. Oh yeah. That's cool. You know? I think it was more me trying to fit in. Now it would have been different if I was trying to fit in with different people, you know, but the people I wanted to hang out with were drug dealers and people that hung out on the street and stuff. People that, it was a small town. Everybody knew that these people I was hanging out with were bad news. Like well known.
Right.
Like they're in the newspaper all the time. You know what I mean?
So did you get through high school?
I dropped out right around the same time. I think 16, about 16, 17, I dropped out. And, okay, well, let's back up a little bit. So before I dropped out, And during this whole rebellious period, my parents kind of gave up on being able to control me, and they went to court to put me on a thing called CHINS in Massachusetts. That's Child in Need of Service. So basically I was on probation, like youth probation, just because my parents didn't want to deal with me. I still did not care, still snuck out, still stole my dad's car, mom's car, whatever. It didn't matter. And the government and the state took me out of my home and put me in foster care.
You wanted to go to college.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to do that?
So I went to Benjamin Franklin Institute of Technology for a brief time to be an automotive technician. Again, I just partied through that school, skipped class, sold drugs, did drugs, snuck people into the dorms.
What course did you take to learn that?
It was just automotive tech. Like,
they taught the whole drug dealing thing?
I wish. No. Yeah, it was in Boston in Back Bay. So it was like just easy. It's a city. It's a big city. You walk outside, there's drugs on the corner.
So you wanted to be there. You wanted to learn, but you wanted to get high more.
Yeah.
So other than going to Maine for a GED and going to South Carolina for several months of basic training, you spent most of your time in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I lived in Massachusetts until I was 22. And then I kind of moved around a little bit, but always kind of wound up in Massachusetts. Yeah, lived in Brooklyn for a very brief time. I traveled a lot. Before I moved to Florida in 2017, I was, this is kind of ridiculous, but I took a road trip from Boston to Phoenix, Arizona, and I was going to live in Phoenix with a girl I was dating and her daughter. The 3-week road trip was absolute hell. We did not get along the entire time.
Was there a lot of traffic?
No, none. It was just open road. It was beautiful. And I wish I still had all the pictures, but she'll never give them to me. But that was the plan. We're going to go check out Phoenix. And we get to Phoenix. And I think about a week into being there, my girlfriend leaves and says, I'm going to move to LA. A friend of mine left LA and has an apartment to rent. I've always wanted to live in LA. She was like an aspiring actress and stuff. So she went to LA and left me with the daughter.
How old?
The daughter was, I think, 7 or 8 at the time. 5 when we met. Then when I was 22, and I lived in a tent in the backyard, the father of the daughter with the father's girlfriend.
Okay. Now, now the lady who moved to LA had a daughter. You lived with the daughter in a tent.
No, the daughter lived in the house.
The daughter lived in the
house.
With the father.
And I lived in the tent.
And the actress was the former spouse of the guy in the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So what the hell? Dr. Seuss.
So I met her at a bar. Okay. I was in a halfway house. The state sent me to a 1-month rehab. And when I got out,
This is after the tent.
22. This is before this. This is how we met.
Okay.
And so I'm in this halfway house and I sneak out of the halfway house and I go to this bar downtown and she's the lead singer in the band singing at the bar. We're talking, we hit it off, blah, blah, blah. We wind up seeing each other. She has this daughter. I move in with her and the daughter.
From the halfway house, you go to move in with her.
Out of the halfway house.
Better situation.
Yeah.
Halfway house, you're not
better situation.
Yeah.
Get this. The father of the daughter lives in that house downstairs with his girlfriend. And there's another roommate, another friend.
You're there. With the singer upstairs.
I'm with the singer upstairs.
What kind of music did you upstairs. What kind of music?
She was
did
like
you...
a psychedelic rock. No,
I was
going
to ask you, what kind of music did you make upstairs?
All the music. But it was, you know, I'm go with the flow. I'm like, yeah, this is new age stuff. They're kind of, you know, it's like right. We're all cool with each other. And that did not work out well at all. We wound up moving to Boston, me and my girlfriend and the daughter, while my girlfriend at the time went to school. She was in school for to be a psychoanalyst, and she was in grad school. So I spent my days waking the daughter up, getting her ready for school, walking her to school, picking her up from school, doing homework with her, feeding her dinner, getting her ready for bed and all that stuff. So I was like a stay-at-home stepdad type dude for about like 2 years.
Wow.
The relationship kind of started out on a lie anyway. It was like it wasn't a good base for a healthy relationship. And I decided I would go stay in Iowa with my birth family. And they were all, so my birth mother in Iowa and my half brother out there, they were always like, you would love it out here. You should really come out here and like spend, you know, move out to Cedar Rapids. It's so cool. There's so much for you. Oh, you're a musician and an artist, like totally come out here. And I fed into that and I was like, you know what? I'm leaving you. I'm going to go to Iowa. Like, goodbye. And I get to Iowa and I'm staying with my brother out there, my half brother. And it was not even remotely close to what they said it would be. And they were not even remotely like nice or cool or anything. My birth mother was like, okay, a little bit. But this guy, my brother, was like totally psychotic, just off the walls all the time, probably on meth or something. I don't know. But that was like, it was a really like low point when I was like, that's where I turned. So that I just left my entire world to go to Iowa because they said it would be a good idea. And, so I was with my brother for a month and he was like beating his wife in front of me and stuff. And I had to like pull a shotgun on him out there one time to get him to stop. And I bought a car for $700 and I took off and I called my birth mother and I was like, this is what's going on. I don't know where to go. I got a car. Like, can I come stay with you for a little bit? She's like, sure. Driving there, mind you, I have a suspended license from all the dumb shit I've done in Mass. And I get pulled over like an hour outside of Cedar Rapids on my way there. And I have to call her and have her and her husband come and get the car and drive me back. It's like the middle of the night. So they do that. They're like excited for me to be coming to stay with them. And I get there and both of them are incredibly mentally unstable as well. Like full blown, unmedicated, bipolar, fits of rage and all kinds of stuff. Like just in front of me, not even directly.
Between themselves.
Yeah. Just alone, even just having full mental.
How did
breakdown.
That make you feel?
Oh, scary. It was scary. Also, it made me worry, like, that's my blood. Like, what do I have? You know, what are my, you know, what's my medical history or whatever? So while I'm in Iowa, I started dating this girl who was a violent alcoholic. And when I say violent alcoholic, I mean she was violent and an alcoholic. Every night, just cases of Bud Light thrown him back and getting physical, like punching me in the face, splitting my eyebrow open. I remember one night we got back from the bar and I went to shower and clean up and get ready for bed. And when I came out of the bathroom, I got a pint glass in the face that was full of whatever she could find under the sink. And I got a really bad chemical burn that was like smoldering and like smoke was coming off of me. And I had to go to the hospital.
So I want to take you, there's a fabric of your tapestry of different levels of drug and behavioral insanity leads you today, who I see in front of me is somebody who's very fucking sane.
Yeah.
And very stable.
For sure.
So can you take us to how it is you went from all of this crazy to the person I'm, the Ben I'm meeting, seems like a wonderful guy who any of our listeners would want to be friends with.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where did that transition start happening?
So I have always had this like desire and like a drive to like figure, I want like answers. You know, I've like wanted to know the answer to the universe or whatever. I've always been looking to the stars and space and like, what is the big picture? You know what I mean? So, really I contribute like my, where I am today through like all the help I've received. Honestly, it's like, I have a therapist who's very spiritual, and the rehab I went to was the perfect fit for me. The people that helped me through that were, you know, just incredibly knowledgeable. And the AA, CA, all the A's, the just program, like yeah, I mean,
when's the first time you went to an AA meeting?
The first time I went, I was really young. I was court ordered. But, you know, I left early, sat outside, just smoked cigarettes or something. But
when did you catch it?
My first AA meeting that really clicked was in treatment 2020, like November of 2020. And
you're about 32.
Yep. Yeah. 31, 32. Yeah. And, they had a H&I speaker, come in and like, yeah, I could relate to certain stories and stuff.
H&I hospital.
Yep. Institution. Hospital institutions. Yeah. Yeah. So they would have somebody come and run a meeting rather than us doing it there. Mm-hmm. And this guy was telling his story about his mania and his psychosis during, you know, his drug induced mania. And it was the first time I had actually heard somebody like really go into that detail and have it make sense and be like, whoa, that's what I have. Mm-hmm. That's it. And how well he was doing. Now this guy like was all beat up, you know, but like he looked the way I felt, but he felt the way I wanted to feel. So I heard that and I broke down crying. I was like freaking out. I was like, you know, I need to get through this. And yeah, I've had the same therapist for years. I still see her twice a week. I think that is one of the bigger things that helps.
So the way this guy felt, you were attracted to that.
Yeah, for sure.
So did that lead towards your getting involved with 12-step fellowships?
Yeah, so when I got out of treatment, I did, you know, they say go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I did 90 meetings in like 60 days or something. I like went all in. However, I didn't understand it. Like, I just went to the meetings. I couldn't really share. I didn't have the confidence to raise my hand. I didn't have the confidence to go up and talk to anybody. If somebody was like, hey, you know, welcome, I'd be like, ugh.
Did you connect with a sponsor?
I had a few sponsors that lasted barely like a week each, maybe. I would just blow through sponsors because I didn't get along with them, or, oh, they weren't the type of person I want to hang out with.
Did you ever go through the steps?
Yeah, just recently, actually. Okay. Finally, I would always get to like step three or four. And honestly, the sponsors I started out with, they were taking too long. They weren't trying to get me through the steps, you know. I go by the book. And I'm lucky that I found a sponsor who wants to go by the book. The sponsors I had in the beginning wanted me to like read all this other crap, write a essay, call every morning, call every night. Like, no. Like, I'm not doing all that. Some people need that. I get that. I wasn't that bad where I felt like, oh, that's what I need to do. Oh, he says do that, then I'm going to do all of that. But again, during that time, I didn't understand giving my will over to my higher power. I didn't understand it. I thought that meant, I didn't know what that meant. That meant like, oh, don't make any decisions for myself and let everybody else make the decisions. Like, let my sponsor tell me what to do for every single thing in my life. Like, no, not your sponsor, not people around you, your higher power. That's who you listened to. The way it happened was like grace of God for sure, because that's like how I contribute everything to in my life right now. It's like, there is no way that it's anything else. There's just no possible way that it's me, that it's anything else other than the grace of God, that I'm here doing this with you guys, that I've even met you guys, that I was at that event. There's no other way. Because if I wanted to do something like that, I would have fucked it up. I would have been somewhere else. It's just completely evident in that.
What advice would you give yourself if you were able to talk to your bar mitzvah Ben?
Yeah. So I've actually done this a lot, written letters to myself. I'll still do it once in a while. Have compassion for yourself in any situation. Like, those moments when you're frustrated and you feel stuck, you just want to lash out, or you're not getting what you want. Feel that and have compassion for that part of you that wants that. And, you know, and love yourself. I know it sounds so like broad and hard to do, and it is, but that's what needs to be focused on, I think.
That you're enough.
You're enough, yeah.
Ben, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to remind people who are watching us, I'm going to look at this camera because that's what they tell me to do. To like and subscribe, comment, tell us what you like, what you don't like, and we'll do more of what you want if you tell us. And, thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time.